we managed ourselves well because there were three of us running the company, right? And we did a pretty good job of I'll handle this job, you handle that job. But really, we could have done more, which we do a lot more of now, not knowing, collaborative discussions. Hey, I'm going to handle this. Don't do it. I'm not going to update you on it. I'm going to manage it. I'm going to take care of it. I'll give you an update monthly. We were always on top of each other. We had nothing to do. You know, there was time. We were trying to manage that. So a much more structured, put your name on every single job that needs to get done. And your job as a CEO is to take your name off every single spot, have someone else do that. And that type of idea, that type of structure of knowing everything that has to be done and who's going to be what and are responsible for it and let them go do it. I think we could have done a much better job with that as we grew. We could have grown a lot faster. There are so many little things we did wrong, but then a lot of things we did right. But I don't know that any of those were mistakes. They just got me here, right? So you have to, maybe that's a way to see it, is there's no mistake. There's just learning experience.
You are listening to Fingerprints on Success, the podcast dedicated to highlighting unique imprints left by business leaders, mentors, and successful entrepreneurs. In this show, we'll be bringing on a diverse range of serial entrepreneurs, professionals, leaders, and coaches to uncover the secrets behind achieving success both professionally and personally. Guiding you on this podcast is none other than Bill Barrett, an award-winning corporate and business law attorney and CEO of the law firm Mandelbaum Barrett PC, where he and his team have provided a full array of legal services to both businesses and individuals throughout the country. Get ready and let's get to the show.
Today, I'm thrilled to bring you an interview with the remarkable Frank Gazzillo, the CEO of Accurate Neuromonitoring. We talk about Frank's extraordinary journey, uncovering how he transformed his company from a humble beginning, fueled by a home equity loan, into one of the premier neuro intraoperative monitoring giants along the Eastern Seaboard. Frank opens up about the fascinating world of neuro intraoperative monitoring and sheds light on the pivotal role his technicians play in surgeries, particularly in spine procedures. We explore his transition from a chiropractor to the helm of a leading neuromonitoring company, delving into the challenges and triumphs of scaling a healthcare business across multiple states. But that's not all. Frank shares invaluable insights into building a successful organizational culture and empowering teams. He candidly discusses the hurdles faced in the early days, including taking out a home equity line of credit to kickstart the business, and emphasizes the pivotal role culture played in its subsequent growth. Don't miss out on this episode packed with wisdom and inspiration. Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Barrett. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Mandelbaum Barrett, and welcome to our podcast today. Today, our guest was Frank Gazzillo, who's the CEO of Accurate Neuromonitoring. Frank's journey is a great story, how he started this company literally from a home equity loan and an idea and grew it into one of the largest neuro intraoperative monitoring companies on the Eastern Seaboard. Some great takeaways today on Frank's journey. A lot of discussion about how he used culture and empowering people to scale his company. I particularly loved some of the comments about his father and the mentorship he received from him. But even maybe more so when Frank gets into the part of the story today where he talks about seeing how his Italian immigrant family lived and grew up and the opportunity he was given and his desire to be able to be successful in what he did in life because he felt like he really owed it back to those that gave him a great opportunity. I think it was a really wonderful discussion. I think all of our entrepreneurial clients out there and our friends will really enjoy Frank's story. So without further ado, here's our episode with Frank Gazzillo. Hello, everybody. I'm Bill Barrett. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Mandelbaum Barrett. Welcome to our podcast, Fingerprints on Success. I'm thrilled to have as my guest today, Frank Gazzillo. Frank is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Accurate Neuromonitoring. Frank's a longtime friend and a client, and has a wonderful story of entrepreneurship. And Frank, welcome to the show, first and foremost. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Bill. Really appreciate you having me.
And, you know, Frank, I think maybe before you jump into your story, how did you
get to where you are now and enter into this business and kind of it's a wonderful story of starting it from scratch. Tell our audience a little bit about what neurointeroperative monitoring is and what your company does, and then maybe kind of take us down memory lane and walk us to where you are now and how you got there.
Sure. Thanks. So again, appreciate you having me on, Bill. I'm going to tell you about a little bit about intraoperative monitoring. So neurointeroperative monitoring is a procedure done, we're a service industry. We provide technicians to surgery, to surgeons during surgery. So our technicians actually go into the case itself, they sit next to the person, and they monitor their nerves during surgery. So for instance, if you had a herniated disc in your neck, and they were going to cut your neck out open, go in, take that disc out, and put a fake disc in, they're right next to the spinal cord and right next to all these nerve roots. So if the doctor wants to identify certain structures, or if he touches something he shouldn't, or he wants to avoid a certain thing, we run electrical signals up and down from your feet and your hands up to your brain and back and forth. And our technicians monitor that with a doctor looking on remotely. And they work together as a team to say, hey, doc, avoid this, watch that. So they're helping protect the patient during surgery, mostly spine surgery. We also do carotid endarterectomies when we do thyroid tumor resections and brain surgery. So those types of procedures.
Okay. So in this surgical setting, you know, you are paid to provide that service, and it's in essence kind of part of the overall surgical experience in these types of surgeries.
Correct. The surgeon will call us in on specific cases, not every case, obviously. But if he's got this certain kind of case where he thinks it's an extra layer of protection to have us there to help guide him through the surgery, he will call us and we will go. We provide this service at about 350 hospitals from Florida up to New York. So we're in 11 states, working with about 500 or so different surgeons per year.
Wow, that's incredible. So then the logical question is, how'd you end up in such a kind of unique space? Tell us a little bit about, and you know, let the listeners know a little bit about you and kind of how you ended up on this journey to neurointeroperative monitoring.
Sure. So, all right. So I grew up in New Jersey. I actually went to school down at Parker College down in Texas. I was a chiropractor. I was a chiropractor for 10 years, got a diplomate in neurology. I got a diplomate in pediatrics. So I liked studying and got into neurology early on. I then had a neurological testing company. I also had an ultrasound business, so a little bit of an entrepreneurial slant to the way I think of things. And a friend of mine came back and he got a job doing this, intraoperative monitoring. He was what our techs are now. So he went to school with him. So the two of us play golf, we would hang out, we were friends. And he said, I'm doing this thing, I think it's really cool. And he would tell me about it. We both had the neurology background. So I said, this is really exciting, interesting stuff. I want to run a business. I love being a chiropractor. It's a lot of fun. It was very rewarding. But I wanted something different. I wanted to run a business. So I sold the two practices off. We started this business. I mean, literally, you know, you've heard the story before, but it's true for me. I took out a home equity line of credit on the house, which is about all the money I had at the time, with one baby, Frank, who's now 17, and my other son on the way, and said, I'm going to take out a home equity line of credit and make this happen. And people asked me, how did you know it was going to happen? I didn't. I had to make it happen. So we just did. And that's how we literally started. We started with three doctors in New Jersey, providing them service. So my partner said, I'll do the work. You run the business. Well, quickly, we grew so much. I was in the OR doing these cases. We bootstrapped it from the beginning. I remember writing Nancy, our first employee ever, our first check, payroll check on a piece of paper with a stub. Had to call the accountant and say, what do I write on this paycheck stub for taxes? Wrote that out, handed it in. That woman, Nancy, still works for us today. God bless her. So 16 years she's been with us. And so we started that way, and we provided, I thought, a great service in two matters. One, clinical excellence. And we came into the OR with my background, and I said, I could read an MRI. I understood the human anatomy. I understood neurology very well. So when I talked to a surgeon, we had a great rapport, great communication. And that's what we imported into our all of our technicians that we hired. We stressed, you have to have this clinical excellence. You really have to have a rapport with the doctor. That helped us grow quickly. We started picking up more doctors in New Jersey. We partnered, brought another partner, about 3 years in, who had been selling hardware. So the rods and screws that they put in during these surgeries, He had sold this to surgeons. So he knew a lot of surgeons we needed to know. We brought him on board and we expanded into New York. We then kept growing through. We then had more of a sophisticated sales marketing piece to our business that we had not had before. So we started expanding through New York, through New Jersey. We're growing very well. And then in 2016, we brought in, we did a small acquisition in New York City. That was nice for us. And we said, maybe we want more of this. So we went out and found a private equity firm. And thanks to your help, we brought on a great private equity firm who's been a great partner for us for the last 7 years. We brought them in. And after that, we got a bit more sophisticated. Full CFO. We now had debt. We had banks to manage. So got a bit more sophisticated, just to put it that way, mm-hmm. in many avenues. And then we did another acquisition of a company in Georgia. So that brought us to Florida, Georgia, Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina. From there, we expanded into Virginia, a little bit in Pennsylvania. We then wound up buying another company in Pennsylvania, another one in New Jersey. As you may know, you weren't on it, but you'll know just a couple months ago, we closed on another one in Tampa.
I'm aware.
Used to be me and you doing these things back in the day, but Casey killed it for us, and they did a great job. They always do. So we got two more we're looking at right now. And so we've just kind of grown through acquisition and organically. But I've also grown for myself personally. The business has grown as a professional organization, and I've grown into the really, I was always the CEO, but more into a real CEO who manages an executive team and lets them do their job. So it's an exciting journey. It's been going on for 16, almost 17 years, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the reasons I thought it would be great for our listeners to have you on really goes to the heart of the journey. You know, you started this business from scratch, as you said, with literally a home equity line of credit, and you grew it. And then you got to a point where you brought in a private equity partner and you had the opportunity to create some liquidity, but also have a professional partnership going forward with investment in the company to grow it. And you've kind of been going through these various steps. And I know you talked about the acquisitions, and we are grateful that we worked with you on all of those. But one of the things I think is kind of interesting to talk about, and I guess I appreciate it too, being in my position with a growing organization, is how did you scale what it takes to, I mean, you went from being in one state with a few people, right? And now you're on the whole Eastern Seaboard. You've got how many employees now?
140.
140 employees. And as you said, you're servicing like over 500 surgeons, 500 doctors. How do you build out the infrastructure, the culture? You know, like you said, you know, I think that's a really interesting thing to talk about a little bit, just because so many of our business owners, you know, as they grow a business, like nobody gives you kind of a playbook on, hey, this is how you scale a company and this is how you make it all work. How do you make it all work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there's a few thoughts come to my mind when you say that. First of all, I think you have to be based in something and stick with it, right? So you have to have a feeling and a belief of how you want to do it, and that grounds you. So this high clinical quality, this feel of family, like one of our first company parties we had in my backyard, right out here. So that sure. feel, you have to keep it going. So we give our teams certain budgets and say, I don't want you to come under budget, go over budget, if anything, spend it on the team, get them together, get that organization, you know, organizational feeling of family together. So we really do emphasize that. And I support that in many ways. I've gone over the years, fly around from region to region, Tampa to Jacksonville, to Atlanta to Charlotte, and just sit down and say, you know, that guy up in Jersey who runs the company, if I had him, I'd tell him this. Here I am. We're just having dinner. Tell me what it is. Because if I'm the smartest guy in the room in every aspect, we're in real trouble. We need input from everyone. So I'll give you a for instance. So here's two things. And stop me. I don't mean to brag. I'm just saying this is what we did. We did.
No, it's this is great because this is what people want to hear. You know, you've done it successfully, and not everybody has a magic recipe, and you figured it how to make your magic recipe. So it's great.
Yeah. So, okay. So everyone knows the idea of scaling, right? Growing the company without growing, you know, the COGS or expenses linearly. You want to grow the top line with everything else, the margins growing as well. Now, how do you do that? So that's on paper, and that makes sense. But the real scaling of the company is getting everyone on board and getting everyone really excited about what the company has to do. So reaching out constantly to everyone in the organization with emails, with videos, I do that a lot. Another thing I do a lot of, like I said, is meet the teams. Another thing I do a lot of, I created something called the ELT, I call it, the extended leadership team. So I have my group of executives, five of us, right? That's so the executive team. But then I have a group of 13 people in my extended leadership team, someone from billing, HR, operations, the reading physicians, the finance. I bring them all together and I say every month we meet, we put down a presentation, and I have them do their presentation and they share. And this is just a place where we say for an hour, we want to borrow all your minds. So I'm going to give you problems, give me thoughts and results. And we just put this out, and so many great ideas come from it. People just want to share and help each other out. I think when they see someone doing something that seems odd, why does this person do it that way? Well, after you talk with them, you say, well, all right, here's why. He's got to do this workaround because of something. And then maybe we can fix that. Or if we can't, at least we can understand why they're doing something that way. So that ELT has been tremendous. Another thing I do is something called initiatives. I've done this for a few years. I just had a meeting this morning about them. We're getting ready for our 2024 initiatives. So I extended it to the ELT, and then I extended it to everyone in the company now. I said, if you got an idea, something you'd be proud of at the end of the year to say, you know, you see how we do that now? That was my idea. So I got 140 people to reach out to who all have their own great ideas, and they do. They're wonderful people. So I say, well, bring them to me. I'll support them financially. I'll make sure they happen. I'll guide you. You can do whatever, as much of it, running as much of it as you want, and you manage this project. And so I get a flurry of ideas. Last year, we had like 20 of them. This year, we had about 18 or 19. We picked five. They range from as simple as when the doctors and the techs communicate with each other, how do they communicate? Can we clean that up? Can we have exact language? Give me what the patient, you know, really said to you. So sometimes that's done differently, and we wanted to make that uniform. Just clean it up. Everyone kind of got on board with that. The other one we did was a virtual OR. So in our office in Fairfield, we have a virtual OR where we bring people and train people all the time. There's a dummy laying on a surgical bed with an anesthesia cart right there and drapes. And then we have we run a procedure and train people and say, stick the needles in. And, you know, we can mess with the computer while they're doing it. It's a simulator mode. And so from that all the way down to everything else we do in the company, a lot of these ideas came from these multiple ideas of this extended leadership team, this initiatives idea. So bringing people together, collaborating, getting ownership, that's how you scale it. Let them grow it for you.
And it sounds like what you're really attributing a lot of it, the success to, is the building and continuation of a certain culture and a business culture that people embrace and it becomes kind of who you are.
Which is really
great. So let me shift gears on you a little bit. You know, when you reflect upon this success, and I've had the opportunity, you know, with our firm having worked with you guys all this time, literally from the beginning, to watch the journey. But when you reflect on it, are there certain mindsets or guiding principles that you think that maybe at the time you didn't even know that you were engaging in or doing, but now that when you think about it, do you have certain mindsets or guiding principles that you think have been a contributing factor to the success that the company has enjoyed?
Yeah, I'd say the one we were very conscious of was in the beginning, it came out of my partner I told you about earlier, who was doing this elsewhere. So he would get a call and say, you got a case you have to do in Long Island, and we're in New Jersey. And he's like, oh, it's 4 o'clock. I got to drive out to Long Island now to do a case. That's a disaster. And he said, you know, I'm driving past two other people. Why am I driving past them? They're out there already. Because they didn't pick up their, at the time, pager. So, you know, they didn't pick up their pager and respond. So the company stopped calling them and said they never respond. So the negative culture this created was horrible and had a terrible effect, which is why he left, which is why we started our own company and took a lot of their work from them. It was, they were clinically excellent, but they didn't respect the people they had. They didn't respect the true asset they have, which is all their employees. And so we've put that first. I have done a talk with all the billing people, not so much lately, but when we started out and for the first 10 years, every time we hire a billing person, I'd bring them in and have a talk about what we do. This is actually there's a patient who's some 40-year-old man or woman who's getting surgery on their neck, and everyone in their family is very nervous. Like, it's a real thing, right?
Sure.
And so I said, you're just billing codes, but you should know really what we do and attached to that. So I have that talk with them. But when I do that talk, I say, here's a day in the life of a technician who's in the OR. Well, can't they just get an extra form? Can't they just get an extra signature? I'm like, they're not there for signatures and forms. They're there to take care of the healthcare service we provide to take care of these people. And so after or before they can get the forms, which we'll need signed, and everyone has their you know, forms they have at their business of some sort. I said, but I really want you to know that this is a medical service that takes care of people first. So that people first medical service is important. And then very closely after, all the people, our employees, make sure we take care of them. If you take care of them, they'll take care of you. You know, they all of a sudden I find that they went, well, you know, I was doing my surgery. It was done. I saw there's another surgeon working. So I got his name. Maybe you want to call him. That's not part of their job. It's not a thing they have to do. But they said, I thought I'd help you out because you help us out. And that kind of culture that we created was take care of people and they'll take care of you. And so, and then it's gone beyond them taking care of me. They take care of each other. I'll take a case for you. You could stay late. I know it's your kid's birthday. All of a sudden, there's all this camaraderie that occurs. And I think it came because we put that out there and they see the same thing and they sort of mirror it, which I think is awesome.
I think that's great. A friend of mine loves to say the quote that culture, you know, what is it? Culture eats strategy for breakfast every time or something. It's something along the, I'm probably bastardizing the quote, but it goes to the heart of the fact that, you know, you can have all the greatest ideas and business plans and charts and graphs and everything else, but culture will eat it alive all the time.
Absolutely.
So look, we always talk about success and the show is Fingerprints on Success, but there is no success without failures or pitfalls or stumblings along the way. And I think our business owners and entrepreneurs that are listening would love to hear some stories or thoughts from you on, you know, if you could, you know, if Frank today could tell Frank from 10 or 15 years ago something not to do or to look out for or whatever, what would it be? What are some of those blind spots or things that they should be looking out for?
Yeah. You don't have enough time here.
There's no restriction on the shows.
There's a billion things we did wrong, or, you know, we didn't do wrong. It's Thomas Edison. We learned another way not to make a light bulb, right? We just learned how to and how not to do things. So it's funny, I was talking to my son yesterday who was doing a project for Boy Scouts. Anyway, he had to ask me the difference with credit cards, debt, should you have debt? I said, poof, that's a conversation. I said, but at one point I had like four credit cards going and we were maxing them out and trying to pay because we were borrowing and hiring and, you know, money was coming in, but we couldn't hire people fast enough and supplies. And so it was such a managing it. So, you know, made a bunch of errors that way. I would have gotten, you know, secure more debt early on. I would have grown, I would have more aggressively marketed and grown more. We were always like, just not too much. Let's just take it slow. So there's a balance between let's grow at the right pace and then let's push more. So probably could have pushed more. But I did like the fact that we grew from one central spot and expanded. We didn't try and go, you know, shotgun all over the country. I think that would have been a mistake for us. The other big thing, I think, pitfall was, so we managed ourselves well because there were three of us running the company, right? And we did a pretty good job of, I'll handle this job, you handle that job. But really, we could have done more, which we do a lot more of now, not knowing, collaborative discussions. Hey, I'm going to handle this. Don't do it. I'm not going to update you on it. I'm going to manage it. I'm going to take care of it. I'll give you an update monthly. We were always on top of each other. We had nothing to do. You know, there was time. And we were trying to manage that. So a much more structured, this is that book, E-Myth by Michael Gerber.
Oh,
so
sure.
It says, put your name on every single job that needs to get done. And your job as a CEO is to take your name off every single spot. Have someone else do that. And that type of idea, that type of structure of knowing everything that has to be done and who's going to be what and are responsible for it and let them go do it. I think we could have done a much better job with that as we grew. We could have grown a lot faster. Yeah, I mean, there are so many little things we did wrong, but then a lot of things we did right. But I don't know that that any of those were mistakes. They just got me here, right? So you have to, maybe that's a way to see it, is there's no mistake. There's just learning experience.
Yeah, I think one of the, if you don't mind, one of my observations that I thought was a positive observation was when you had, you know, three partners and working together in the business, I always, it always struck me that you were smart, that you guys played to each person's unique ability. Mm-hmm. You know, the three of you had things that you were good at and things that you weren't good at. And a lot of times entrepreneurs make the mistake of trying to do the things that they're not good at. And whereas it always seemed like you guys had a logical way of putting people in the right lane where they excelled. And I know for you, you know, you've always been the leader of the business and the person that had the big picture vision and the business plan, and understood how to build and to run and to manage. But, you know, can you speak to that a little bit in terms of, was that conscious the way you guys did that? Or was it, or was it something where you just kind of started figuring out your lanes, you know, almost on accident? How did that come about?
Yeah, probably a bit of the latter. I think, so you could say it was lucky, but I think it wasn't so much luck. It just kind of naturally, organically happened. And if it was three people clinically minded and no one knew how to run a business, we probably wouldn't have got off the ground right away, right? It would have struggled, and it would have been one of those, yeah, we tried it, it didn't quite work, right? Or three people that all did sales, that all ran a business, but no one could do sales or growth. It probably would have been like well-organized nothing, right? So I think there's a bit of happenstance where everyone got together and it fit. But you're right, we definitely did fit into our lanes, and it was a big to do where we had a lot of discussions on, let me do this, you do that, and separating things, which is why I pointed out earlier, the ELT, the kind of that kind of a lot of where that comes from. Look, I'm not going to be I'm not going to tell you, oh yeah, I'm in charge, so this has to be this way. Ultimately, at the end of the day, if a decision has to be made, I have to make it, and I have no problem with that. But I get a lot of data from a lot of people, so I'm constantly collecting information. So separating, you know, Greg and Gene and me and everyone doing their own thing was, maybe it was a little conscious. I feel like it was more just intuitive.
Yeah.
Why don't I do it?
Everyone just kind of found their spot.
I'll do this, and then they went, good. Figure out how to set up a 401k. I'll set it up, and I'll take care of that, and I'm going to figure out bank debt, and I'm going to fill out the, good, I don't want to. And they would be over there trying to figure out a new way to clinically set up a case. I'm like, good, because I don't want to. So that worked. Right. So there was a bit of that. It just kind of had to work, and it did.
Enjoying the show so far? We've received fantastic feedback since we started, and we love your questions. Entrepreneurs face unique challenges, and as a corporate attorney and CEO, Bill understands that. Whether it's your first location, industry regulations, succession plans, or exit strategies for your business, the journey is rarely a smooth one. Mandelbaum Barrett PC offers listeners of this podcast a 20-minute consultation with their award-winning team. From mergers and acquisitions to litigation, they help entrepreneurs navigate new opportunities, get invaluable insights, and support to not just survive, but thrive. Click the link in the episode description or visit mblawfirm.com for details. Once again, it's mblawfirm.com. Now, back to our show.
Okay, that's great. I just thought I'd touch on that because it was interesting for me to observe the way you guys kind of seem to beautifully orchestrate that throughout. So one question I want to ask you too, one of the reasons why I named the show Fingerprints on Success, there was a bunch of reasons, but one of them is kind of how other people often have their fingerprints on the success of others, you know, mentorship. And when you think back on your career and the success you've had, you know, is there a particular person out there or maybe persons that when you reflect on it, you say, wow, you know, but for what I learned from that person or but for the way they took me under their wing, I might not have gotten here.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of people I should thank, a lot of people I'm very fortunate to have met, and a lot of people who I owe a lot to. I'll talk to this in a number of ways. So I've always felt, you know, the reason I help out with my boys, with Boy Scouts, and that, me and a couple of guys run the troop, is because there were people who did this when I was, well, it's my kids, and I'm going to help out whatever they do, but also to help out other kids, because when I was a kid playing baseball, there was some parent there every day at practice. You know, you didn't realize it at the time, but as you get older, you start to realize that guy wasn't getting paid for that. And he stayed extra, and he helped out, and I owe it back. Right. I feel a very strong sense of I owe this back to somebody, the universe, if you would. It's not sure. This particular guy, you know, but you owe it back to society to help someone else out. So I feel that strongly. So there is a sense of, in that regard, there is a sense with mentors, we're talking about mentors, with my father. So he helped me a lot growing up. He had his own business, did office furniture, you know, like cubicles that you see. Mm-hmm. He'd fix them, repair them, install them. Him and his brother owned a business, and they had that for over 50 years.
Yeah. Had it so you grew up with entrepreneurship right in front of you with your dad.
Yeah, I was 7, 8 years old. I'd carry his tools around and give me like a quarter an hour. and I learned it, and I thought, I mean, back even then, I would think to myself, he would tell the guys, "Hey guys, break's over, let's go." And I was like, "Wow, that's aggressive." Now you realize sometimes you got to do that. And I thought, why don't you have a meeting with these guys and tell them you do that side of the room and you do that side of the room, and we'll work with each other. Back then, I had those things in my head, like, how would you manage this? How would you talk to this group of people? And I was just going around collecting garbage, and, you know, I was like 7, 8-year-old kid, just following them around. But I kind of grew up with that mindset of entrepreneurs. And I saw that and said, I always wanted to own my own business, just like my father did. Now, one thing I learned from my father, which isn't a positive thing necessarily, he said, I had a job. I wanted to own a company because I wanted me and my brother, his brother Pat, to have income. So now I get older and I realize, so you wanted all the work of an employee, but all the responsibility of an owner. It's exactly the wrong way. And then you read Robert Kiyosaki's, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. There it is, right? And so, but he worked his butt off. He did it for his family. He had to do what he had to do to make it work. There's a lot of work ethic piece that I got from my father, 100%. So learned work ethic, learned those pieces from him. Not so much business. So if we talk about business mentors, I'd say Michael, my CFO, he's been in 5 different private equity owned companies. This guy, he is a real entrepreneur, a real mentor for me. He has taken me from running the business as the CEO to a real CEO that I feel like could be dropped into another company and can manage that. There's definitely a skill set to that. And I've learned so much from him and his experiences that I owe him a huge debt of gratitude. So I feel like this payback, this working to pay it forward, I'd say the two biggest ones, some were positive and negative. You learn from both my father and Michael that really influenced me to become a better CEO and leader. Those are probably two of the biggest. And then the last one, if I had a mentor, not really a mentor, it's an attitude, is I just have this burning itch in the back of my head, I call it, where I go, I don't understand that. You got to keep explaining it. Like I'm a kindergartner. It's just, you got to do it again. And either you have that or you don't, right? And so I just always had this, I learned so much from my CPA that I worked with, well, that did my taxes and other things back when I was a chiropractor. And he's like, well, this is a business. Let me show you a P&L. I'm like, I don't even know what that is. Never took any business classes. This is 20 years ago. And I just went, well, what's that? And why is this? And what are we doing here? I mean, I've asked you more questions.
Well, you're making me go down memory lane, because one of the things that always struck me about you when we interacted was you would ask a lot of questions and of course I would answer them, but I always thought a technique you had, I don't even know if you know that you do this, but you probably do now, but it always struck me what you would do is then you would say, all right, let me explain it back to you.
Yeah.
And this is unique. Like, I mean, I've represented, probably over 1,000 people over the years. It always struck me that after we talked about it and after you asked questions, you would then explain it back to me to see if you had it right. And right. Then I'd be like, yeah, actually, yeah, Frank, that was exactly right. That was an excellent explanation of it back. But that's intellectual curiosity, right? Like what you're really saying is that you really like to know and really know and really understand, right. Not just say, oh, well, I spoke to Bill, the lawyer, and he said that right. This is the law and this is what we should do, or the accountant. You wanted to know why we were doing it, mm-hmm. and make sure that you understood how and why.
Right.
And so I think that's actually funny that you should bring it up, because if someone were to ask me a question about you that was unique, I would say the way you would, in essence, give the advice back to me and see if you had it right, I always thought was kind of unique.
Yeah, and that is something I learned and I do on purpose now. And I do that even when I want to explain something for someone to do. So I want you to do this. Okay, now tell me what I just told you. What am I asking of you? And they go, you were just saying yes. I don't want yes. Tell me so that I know that you know. And then we have agreement. And so I do that a lot. And I've learned a lot from, on the M&A side and all these acquisitions from you and Casey, she's awesome. But from you, your team learned so much that we do all the time now, right? And so, it is a technique I've used and it tends to work.
No, it does. And I think it's great, by the way, that you mentioned when you talk about mentors and people that have made an impact on you. Not that I'm trying to brag for you here, but you know, you bring on someone like Michael as a CFO, and technically, you know, if you're going by a corporate governance chart, you know, you're his superior, right? He's right. Subordinate to you, but yet, you know, you're giving credit to someone for teaching you so much and helping you go to the next level, based on their talent and their skill, you know, that you brought on to work for you and work with you. But, you know, I think that's a tribute to you and kind of your mindset, too, on the way you treat people and the way you respect the people that you work with. So I think that's really a great thing. And by the way, I only mention it because it's unique. Very rarely do I hear someone, whether it's on this program or just in conversation, talk about, you know, how much they learned from someone else who maybe they, you know, they brought on to work for them or with them. You know, a lot of times people, as you said, think they're the smartest person in the room. So I think that's great. So good for you on that. So let me twist this around on you now. Let's get to a little bit of a current events type of conversation. You know, world is in flux, lots of stuff always going on in the world. But share with our listeners, for the business owners and entrepreneurs out there, share a little bit about kind of a hot topic or current issue or something that you've been thinking about that you're in the process of trying to successfully navigate yourself that you think is worth sharing in terms of, you know, what's happening, whether it's in your business or in the world or something that you're kind of struggling with or working through right now.
So I'll give you an in the business one, keeping it in the business. One of the biggest struggles we have right now, something called it's something called the No Surprises Act. So a strike of a pen, this stuff happens, right? There's so many, again, this is one of those 20 to 30 second bit that could go on for 4 days.
And this has been on the news a bit too. So it is a current event, the No Surprises Act.
Correct. So this happened. So what happened here was the intention of the bill was, and now law, that started in January 22, was if you're at a network and you send a bill to a patient, technically you could balance bill them. You could bill $1 million. You could balance bill them if they pay $1,000. You could balance bill them for the 999, hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And bankrupt somebody. They didn't want this. And this is one of the biggest reasons for bankruptcy in the country is medical bills. So they wanted to try and avoid that. So what they said was no surprises. If you're at a network and you bill, you can only get paid as if you were in network, and then you could arbitrate after. Well, there's the hidden little gem. So in 21, they put this in place and said, we're going to do this. Well, as you would expect, the government didn't even open the portal to submit your claims until April or May of that year. So nothing happened, right? Imagine not billing a large portion of your people for 5 months. Wow. Then when we billed them, they said, well, we got this legislation wrong and we have to rewrite it and fix it. And they paid some of the bills, but not other ones. So there are a large number of bills from last year to the magnitude of, you know, thousands, 2,000, 3,000, right? When we're doing 1,500.
And that's just you as one provider.
Me as one person.
What does that mean in the big global picture in the
correct,
country?
Correct. And we do 15,000 claims a year. So 3,000, it's a meaningful piece for us. And these are the better paying ones, right? That are still open from January, February, March of 22. And so we have to now navigate. We believe the money will come in that we're waiting for. It's actually coming in more and more every day, thank God. And hopefully the new guidance will come out in January of 24, and that will allow these mediators to pay quicker. But what we've had to do is we've had to navigate this. So there's billing concerns, there's morale concerns, there's bank concerns, there's cash flow, there's revenue. And recognizing revenue goes, what do you do in the past as to what I think you're going to get in the future? Well, if you look at the past, it's not so shiny because the money didn't come in, but it's going to come in. But when's it going to come in? Is it going to come in? So now I have to figure all those pieces out so I can recognize the revenue going forward because it's not all contractual, right? So when you see that type of disturbance, and I talk to every CEO in the country that does intraoperative monitoring, when I look at them, and discuss with them, that is the number one topic. It's the first, it's the second, it's probably the third, fourth, and fifth topic that we talk about. And how do we manage through this? Getting a good team on board that can help collect this for us. We had to change the way we bonus manage our billing team. I used to give them a bit of a bonus on how much they collected. Well, now they can't collect because the money's not coming. Of none of their fault. This is nothing to do with them. So we pivoted earlier in the year. This is one of the initiatives that my head billing and collection person put in place. She said, why don't we manage them on tasks? Now, I hate like busy work. You know, if we're busy, we're good. I want results. Give me cash. That's what we want out of a billing team. But at this point, I couldn't just because. So I said, let's manage how quickly they have claims out, how quickly they arbitrate, how quickly they put them in a process, how many touches they have. And if we keep that process up, I believe that in the end, that will generate, when the money starts to clear, more money coming in quicker. So while I don't typically go that way, for this, it worked. So a nice pivot and a great job from Carrie to make that happen. But you know, those are the kinds of biggest issues we have that we manage through. And it touches the organization top to bottom. I have people asking for initiatives now. Can I spend $150,000, $200,000? I'm like, I mean, kind of, but man, money's tight with all that's going on. And then,
sure. And
then we try to buy a company. And then the bank is looking at us and saying, how's the cash coming in? And it's okay, but it's not as good as it will be. Why don't we wait till it is better? There's a lot of, so that's when you need a good CFO. Go back to Michael again, but a good team that can message this out, that all understands this, that all pulls in the same direction. That's the struggle we have. Probably the biggest struggle we have right now is managing that.
That's a classic, and you see it all the time and unintended consequences of, you know, and I hate to say it, but government, yep. you know, does this kind of thing where it starts with a good cause. It starts right. with something that is based in, you know, trying to do something good or fix an existing problem or whatever. But if you don't think it through and you don't think through the implementation, yeah. everything else, because I mean, I can only imagine, I mean, it's just not neurointeroperative monitoring, right? It's anybody who bills something that's an out of network benefit in healthcare. Right. Pardon me. They're all dealing with the same situation.
Oh, I'm hearing it across the board. And so now the surgeons are slowing down and they're having problems and it's across the board. I mean, there's so many people involved in feeling this pain. And so now you need structures in place. So this is one of those borrow when you don't need the money, build a structure when you don't need it built. We did a lot of this during COVID. So I said, look, we have time because they shut down hospitals. So then they shut us
right.
down. We went from doing 1,400 cases a month to doing 256 in March of 2020. That was a huge hit. And so I said, well, we've got time. If nothing else, we've got time. Let's go rebuild the internal structures that we need built. We put new processes in place electronically, new technologies in place. You would think you'd say with the cases you're doing, really, this is you're doing a lot of monitoring, a lot of a technology around nothing. If the business stayed like that, it'd been bad. But I felt like it was going to come back, and of course it did. But I said, let's build the internal structure. Make sure we build the back house. So from all the different departments we have, we tighten them up so that if something happened, and here we are, we'd benefit from it. And as we come out of this, there's a lot of other companies that I look at that come, they call me all the time and they say, Frank, I don't think we're going to make it. We're having troubles. You know, you want to acquire the company? You want to come on board? Can you take care of some pieces for us? When it was all good, it was easy. So they just let it go. And there's some downside to that of you're not forced. It's almost like a hate operating with a safety net. You feel like I can fail. This is a safety net. You live your life like there's no safety net. You watch everything that happens. So we did that and said, let's make sure we do everything we can just in case. And boom, there it was. This happened. We're in a good spot. Cash is strong. Banks are happy. It could be happier. It could be stronger. Everything's going well. But when we come out of this on the other side, we'll be in a real, real catbird seat. So that's good.
Yeah. And it kind of ties back into the conversation before, too, about scaling. Effectively, what you did is took advantage of the crisis moment where you had the time and looked at forward thinking.
Right.
What's going to benefit our organization? We did some similar things with the law firm mm-hmm. in terms of how can we deliver better service and a better client experience. And,
right.
and you know, you took advantage of that time. And as the companies continue to grow, you've now added to your kind of your infrastructure or the you know, the foundation of what you're able to deliver
right.
is at a higher level. So now that you do these acquisitions and continue to grow, you've built things that maybe you'd have to be figuring out now
right.
that you took advantage of that moment in time.
Yeah.
I one of our partners, I remember when we were in the midst of the pandemic, very similar to what you did, you know, we got on a call one day and said, hey, you know, let's start talking about when there isn't a pandemic. And, you know, like, what's something we could be working on that would be forward thinking, forward moving? And, you know, we actually put a little committee together at the time that started brainstorming and so forth. So that's very cool. And that it's interesting how that's playing to your advantage now. So I got a couple more things for you that I think will be fun. So, you know, I know that, you know, you talked a little bit about your mentors and people that you're grateful for. What do you do? You know, how do you try to pay it forward now? You know, knowing that you had great people that made an impact on success in your life. And what are some of the things that you try to do, whether it be internally or not, or externally that, you know, to kind of pay that forward and, you know, hopefully someday somebody's on a podcast talking about, yeah, was this guy Frank Gazzillo? Let me tell you what he did.
Yeah. So a few things. So we try to do, so we do a mission every year. We send one or two of our technicians with all the supplies they need over to India with a doctor that we work with in Atlanta, Georgia, where he'll do 15, 20 surgeries all free and at his expense. And we send our person at our expense and we fly over there to do these things. So any whenever we get an opportunity to do something like that, I'm always on board for that. And we have a great group of people. Any of these, you know, all the hurricanes and the floods and things like that, we're always raising money and contributing. So we try to be a company that thinks about the community at large, at least within our own selves, right? And how we can reach out to someone. So that's one of the things we do. One of the other things we do, and this kind of ties into, you were talking a little bit about Michael and, you know, complimenting him, and he's kind of someone that would technically answer, report to me. So I had a call with someone that just started with the company just recently, and I never met him, but he got the opportunity to do one of these initiatives for next year. And he was like, wow. And I said, what can I do to help? How do I help you? What can I teach you? What can I educate you on? We've done some educational classes for our leaders in each of the areas, thrown through Rutgers. And so we said, let's put you through a program for that, because you may know technology, but you know the what we do, but you may not know how to manage. So we manage them that way. So I'm trying to find the key people that that I can put in a place and educate. Maybe it's selfishly, then I don't have to do it, right? But it's also for them, so they learn, right? And I've said this to, so one of our other great success stories is Katie. We hired her, she was gonna like answer the phone. And then she was going to help out with some other stuff back. And then she was gonna do this. She's grown to the level of senior accountant, and she's in the finance team, and she's doing awesome. She just got her degree certificate from New Hampshire online.
That's great.
And Michael's taken her, and Tim has taken her under their wing, and she's doing tremendous. But this is the kind of person that I said, I've said this so many times now, I can just repeat it. So I want you to do so well here, and I want you to become so educated here that when you leave, you're an asset to someone else. I don't want you to leave, right? I don't want anyone to go anywhere.
Right. But hopefully you never go.
But when they do go, and eventually somebody will, right? When they do go, I want them to leave not like, oh, I got to get out of here. I want them to leave like, I have to leave. This guy's given me such an opportunity. I got to take it. It's what I always want. Then go for it. I said, now the selfish thing is, for the couple of years while you were still here, I had you at your best. And so there's my selfish piece. But for them, they learned and got advanced and took advantage of, and they became a better person because of it. So that's the way I think of it. To try and get people to the next level, educated. I mean, I'm trying to do that myself. So I'm constantly learning to become a better CEO, best as I can. And I want other people to feel the same and gain the same thing from it. So
I think it's great. And constant and never ending improvement is a great mindset in and of itself for everybody.
Yeah.
So I just have a couple more questions for you. I'm really so grateful for the time you're taking with us. So this is just kind of a fun question, which is, I always find, you know, when people reach a high level of success, you know, everyone who's an entrepreneur, part of measuring success is dollars, of course. You know, financial success is a way of just kind of measuring, you know, what you're accomplishing. But everyone at a point, you know, in their journey, you know, realizes there's something that drives them, right? Some people will call it their why statement. Why does Frank Gazzillo do what Frank Gazzillo does every day? Like, have you ever given thought to kind of, you know, it's not just about, oh, we're going to earn more money or we're going to have a bigger company, but what makes you get up and do the things you do every day?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first, I love it. I mean, I just enjoy it. It's one of those, it's not a job. You know, if you love it, it's not a job. So you have to really find something you love, or what you have really learned to find the piece of it that you really love. So I talk to people and they're like, my job. I'm like, I love Monday morning. I just love doing what I do. And so that makes it a lot easier for me. However, so there is a financial component to it, of course, right? And I want stability for me and my family. But there's also a huge drive so two other things come to mind. So one of them is a huge drive for the responsibility I take on, that I really feel strongly about, of the 140 families that I affect. So running this business, had all these employees, and they buy a house, put their kids in the school. They they go on vacation based on how well we can do. So I think of that very often, like more than weekly, about the responsibility I have to them to make sure this company works well and runs efficiently so they can continue, that they need their financial security and they need to know that they have a place that they can continue to work. And that it's a good place, not just financially, but mentally. If they go home and say, I was a good job, I like what I do. So I take that very seriously, a huge responsibility to run the business right so those people have, so everyone in the company has a great place to work and it has some stability. So my family, yes. My financial situation, sure. I'm not going to say that that doesn't exist. Until I hit the lottery, it's going to be there, right? But at the same time, I feel a real strong attachment to the group, you know, at large. Beyond that, for me personally, so I want to build something cool. I want to have a cool story to tell. I want someone like you, and I appreciate this. It's very cool of you to think of me and say, Frank, this is a cool story. Tell it. And so I love telling the story, and I want to build it bigger and better. I think that's really neat. There's also a bit of a piece of me that my grandparents all came over from Italy, right? And so I get really neat stories and I grew up in Richfield Park in Bergen County, right? So it wasn't bad, but we went on one vacation a year down the shore. We didn't have a lot of money, but we were fine. You know, I'm not crying poorhouse, but we were not overly wealthy by any means. But I went every weekend to Brooklyn to my grandparents' house and my grandmother's house. My grandfather died when my mother was four. So it was a very tight family, all surrounding grandma, and we all went together and met. And I got stories of at that house, railroad apartment in Brooklyn. And we used to play in this one bedroom. There were two beds. And my Uncle John would tell me he didn't have his own bed till he went to the army. He had a shared bed with his brother. Like, that's the way it was, right? Yeah. My mother tells me stories about they had a dresser. They'd pull out the bottom drawer and make a bed, and that was her bed. There was no other beds. There was eight people in this one little apartment. And so they grew up. I'm not saying I grew up like this at all, but sure. I saw it. When you see that, and I hear my Uncle Angelo tell me stories about coming over, and they left Italy for a reason. They wanted to have a better life here. It's why I never spoke Italian. My mother did, but they were like, no, we're here in America. We're going to make it work. We're here for a reason. Succeed. And, you know, and then my uncle would tell me stories about him and my grandfather, who I never met, obviously, would go around and they would work at these buildings. And just like back in the day, they would beef up the coal so that they could have heat in the building. And then they'd bank it down so to conserve it. And these great stories about they get a roast, they'd bring it home and they'd eat it for 2 or 3 days, like just fed the family, right? And so again, I wasn't there, I wasn't that, but I heard that story and saw it. When you do that, it kind of touches you. It touched me. And I went, you know, you got some responsibility. These people came over from Italy, struggled, had all this heartache, you got something, you can't throw that away. You got to respect that. And you have to say, I owe it to them to be successful.
That's a great legacy. That's a great legacy.
You got to kind of pay it back to the people who worked hard. They came here to give you opportunity. You got the opportunity. You damn well better take care of it. So, wow. And then one thing I'd like to do from a financial point of view is if we could do this bigger and better, and get more financially a better situation, and I could find an organization I really want to give more to. You know, you can give more to who you want if you have more. So wouldn't it be neat to be able to, I don't know, I have ideas. I'm still looking for some. So
okay. Well, that could be our next episode, maybe when you flush those ideas out.
Yeah, we'll explore something them. We could do bigger. So.
All right. Anyway. So let me give you my final question that I always like to ask is forward-looking, looking into the future. What has you excited about the future? When you spring out of bed in the morning, what is Frank Gazzillo looking forward to that's got you excited?
So, I mean, first, like I said, I love my job. So every morning when I go to the calendar, I look at it and I say, okay, we got some cool stuff coming on. So I'm very excited about the company. I think we're in a great place. We're growing. We're doing well. We're looking for a few more acquisitions. Probably a private equity group is going to roll off and maybe another one comes on, I would think. But if they said, Frank, we want you to run this with the new group and expand it out westward and keep this thing growing. I'd absolutely love that opportunity. If they said, Frank, you're out. We're going to get another guy in. We're going to merge with this company. I'd say, great. And so that's kind of exciting to be either one works for me. And then they said, look, you know, we're going to take you out of this company, but we got another company and a private equity group, and we want to drop you into this company. They're a $10, $20 million company. We want to scale them up to $100 million. I'm in. I'd love to do that. That'd be so exciting. So it is exciting to know that I've built a skill set, I think. I've built a skill set where I can be plugged into a company and help it grow. That would be really neat. I also could stay on this company and keep it growing, started it and grow it. I think that would be exciting as well. So I see. And then in the near term, what are we doing every day? I mean, I like doing what we do. So helping it grow and building it for the next few years is exciting as well. So there's some. I look at the future and I'm very excited about it.
Well, I think that's great. Obviously, you've done an incredible job with this company from inception. And, you know, look, one thing that I think our listeners are going to take from this conversation is you're a builder. And, you know, and you know, it's obvious in the way you even talk about the business, how excited being a part of a growing enterprise and being a leader of a growing enterprise is for you. So, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join in and be a part of our podcast. I think the stories are great. I feel blessed that I've actually been able to kind of be along for the ride and you know, not only all of the work that we've done with you, but just kind of watching it all happen from the very, very beginning. And it's really been fun, and it's still fun as you continue to do it and grow it and scale it. And I think that everybody can learn a lot from this conversation and from a lot of the things that you've accomplished. So Frank, thanks again for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, and I do have to say, Bill, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on. It really is an honor. Watching you grow your company from where it was when we started to where it is now is an incredible feat. I look to you as, absolutely said it earlier, but to stress it again, as one of my mentors who we've talked so much early on, I asked probably too many questions and wouldn't stop letting you go. I had your ear, I would go on it. But I love learning from you. You're so successful, and I do appreciate that. And you pulling me into this and a couple of other things you've pulled me into is a real honor. And I do appreciate it because I've met some really interesting people through you. So thank you very much for this. I hope it's helpful. And any other time you'd have me on, I'd love to be here.
Thanks, Frank. We'll talk to you soon. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Fingerprints on Success podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe on your chosen platform that you are listening to us on. If this episode made you think of someone, go ahead, take a screenshot and share this episode with them, or post it on your social media to share with your friends. You can catch the show notes for this episode and any mentioned links in the description of this episode. Mandelbaum Barrett PC specializes in partnering with successful business owners and proven entrepreneurs on all of their legal matters. Visit www.mblawfirm.com for more information. Once again, it's www.mblawfirm.com. We'll see you on the next episode.